From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
So many socks. After the pair the Undertaker asked for, I picture them black beneath the fold in your open casket, your toes still cold.
Today, poems about grief. Kevin Young reads from his collection Book of Hours, which includes poems about his father's accidental death and poems about the birth of his son.
It was a way of just writing about the way that the cycle of life informed my life, from death to birth, to in a way a kind of rebirth that I felt afterwards.
Also, tech contributor Alexis Madrigal says that while autonomous self-driving cars aren't in our driveways yet, they're closer than we think. And we remember biographer Justin Kaplan, who also edited Bartlett's familiar quotations. He died Sunday at the age of 88. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Poems about the death of his father are followed by poems about the birth of his son in Kevin Young's new collection, Book of Hours. We invited him to read and talk about some of these poems. He's the author of 7 previous poetry collections, including Ardency, a chronicle of the Amistad rebels, and Jelly Roll, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's also edited 8 books of poetry, including The Art of Losing, Poems of Grief and Healing, Jazz Poems, Blues Poems, and Giant Steps, The New Generation of African-American Writers. His collection of essays, The Gray Album, On the Blackness of Blackness, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Young is a professor of creative writing and English at Emory University, where he's also the curator of the Raymond Donowski Poetry Library, a collection of rare and first editions of modern and contemporary poetry. Kevin Young, welcome to Fresh Air. How far apart was your father's death and the birth of your baby?
About 2 years.
And how did you decide to use those two incidents in your life, one tragic and one beautiful, as the anchors of your book?
Well, they were sort of the anchors of my life in a way. So it was a way of just writing about what had happened and also the way that the cycle of life informed my life from death to birth to, in a way, a kind of rebirth that I felt afterwards.
Well, I want to have you read a poem about the aftermath of your father's death, and this is called Charity. And if you'd like, you can introduce it for us before you read it.
Yeah, this poem is called Charity, and it's a poem about all this kind of aftermath, as you said, of his death, and all the daily things that seem so important and then also seem so unimportant. Things almost flip-flop for you, and it's about trying to sort of track down his dry cleaning. Charity. So many socks. After the pair the undertaker asked for, I picture them black beneath a fold in your open casket, your toes still cold. What else to do? Body bags of old suits, shirts still pressed, long johns, the unworn, unwashed wreckage of your closet. Too many coats to keep, though I will save so many. How can I give away the last of your scent? And still, Father, you have errant dry cleaning to pick up. Yellow tags whose ghostly carbon tells a story, where to look. One place closed for good, the tag old. One place with none of your clothes, just stares as if no one ever dies, as if you are naked somewhere, and I suppose you are. Nothing here. The last place knows exactly what I mean. Brings me shirts hanging like a head, starched collars your beard had worn. One man saying sorry, older lady in the back saying how funny you were, how you joked with her weekly. Sorry. And a fellow black man hands your clothes back for free. Don't worry. I've learned death has few kindnesses left. Such is charity, so rare and so rarely free, that on the way back to your emptying house, I weep. Then drive everything, swaying, straight to Goodwill, open late to live on another body and day.
So, reading that poem, I kept thinking about why you'd want to track down your father's dry cleaning after he was dead. Why did you feel that that was important?
I think I wanted him to be whole again, you know. Obviously, I couldn't have him here again, but I wanted all those parts of him. I mean, almost like Osiris or something, gathering all those pieces of the dead and putting them back together. It seemed somehow important, if only for the act. And then, of course, I gave them right away. And that was kind of also another point, to have them live on a bit like we all wish our loved ones who are no longer with us might.
So you had to give away his clothes. You had to figure out what to give away and what to keep. Were you alone in making those decisions, or did he have a wife? I know your parents were separated, but did he have a wife? Did you have siblings who shared in those decisions?
No, I'm an only child, so it was pretty much on me. I mean, that isn't to say I didn't have support, but, you know, I did have to make those decisions, and some of them quickly, like, you know, decisions about, you know, donating his organs and things, which seemed strange, but seemed also part of that same kind of resurrection and rebirth.
In giving away or throwing away or deciding what to keep of all of your father's stuff, did it change your whole attitude toward possessions and how much you want to own and what you want to keep and what you want to just kind of get rid of while you're alive?
It's an interesting question. I work in archives, and both in terms of my own writing, and also I'm a curator in them. So I always think about that, and I am afraid I tend toward the keeping. I always joke I come from a long line of pack rats, so I get it honest. And he was no exception. But I think the things that were very important to me were really small things. His Mickey Mouse watch, you know, things like that that become sort of totems, if you will. And I think that's what changed for me. It wasn't sort of the big things. It was really the little things that I wanted to keep.
Well, in addition to giving away his clothes, you gave away his organs. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of your poem, Solace. And I'm going to ask you to read the excerpt about donating his organs.
Okay. Yesterday, I had to phone her, my lover, calm as I could, and say above the static that my father was gone, but not quite. First, I must give his body breathed for away. Hello, this is Sarah. We harvested your dad's liver, which tested fine. This morning, it went to a 26-year-old who needed it. One kidney went locally. It was a match. The other, I'll know tomorrow. Do you authorize the skin? Yes. The lungs? Yes. The heart? Yes. The epidermis? Yes. The bone? No. The small intestine? No. The cornea? Yes.
Do they ask about the small intestine? Do you just decide not to give that, or is that?
They ask about everything.
So how did you decide the no with the small intestine?
I don't know. I'm only laughing because I can't remember, you know, it was so intense a moment, you know, and one doesn't, you know, I wish I could answer better that one.
Do you know if he wanted his organs donated?
I do. My father, you know, was the first in his family to go to school, and he went all the way to become a doctor, you know, and so I think that was very important to him. He was an eye doctor, a surgeon. So, you know, the cornea seemed really important. But I, you know, because he was an eye doctor, I had always seen, you know, growing up him watching surgery, you know, at breakfast, which was quite strange. So for me, that was really intense, the things about the eyes. And, you know, I felt like it was going to live on, you know, and I think that's really important. I think he would have wanted that, and I didn't have any doubts about that. It was didn't make it any easier.
Do you know who were the recipients of his organs?
I actually don't. I think that was one place I couldn't quite go and find out. And you know, they're very great about that. And I myself am an organ donor. I think it's really important, but I just couldn't go to find out and discover. But you know, I'm sure they think about it as much as I do.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kevin Young. He has a new collection of poems called Book of Hours. Kevin, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Kevin Young. He has a new book of poems called Book of Hours. And the anchors of the book are poems about his father's death and poems about the birth of his son. I want to ask you to read another poem about your father's death. And, you know, as we've talked about, you had to give away his clothes. You donated his organs. And this is the book about the dogs he left behind in the kennels that he had for them. And this poem was originally published in The New Yorker, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want to, before you read it, set it up for us?
Yes, it's called Bereavement. And in it, I was really trying to find a form and a metaphor for the feelings of grief and bereavement specifically. What was it like? And these dogs, which were true and which I had known and loved, you know, seemed this apt metaphor. This is an excerpt of Bereavement. Behind his house, my father's dogs sleep in kennels, beautiful. He built just for them. They do not bark. Do they know he is dead? They wag their tails and head. They beg and are fed. Their grief is colossal and forgetful. Each day they wake seeking his voice, their names. By dusk they seem to unremember everything. To them, even hunger is a game. For that, I envy.
You know, in your poem about your father's dogs, you ask yourself if they know that he's dead. And that I never thought of that before. Like, you know what I mean? Like, when you die, does your animal knows you're not there, but they don't have a concept of dead. Had you thought about that before your father's death?
Never. I think really that experience, you know, I barely knew. You know, I was trying to grapple with it. And, you know, that's something that's great about dogs, I think, is they're living in the moment, but also their sympathy, their empathy, their connectivity. So I was really trying to capture that in the ways that it felt different from how I felt, as you note, but then also the ways I was, you know, envious of how they could be in the world. And but they still seemed to miss him. They, you know, they still seemed to certainly seek that dailiness that my father had with them.
What did you do with the dogs?
They went to good homes. That saint who came by took one of them, and the other one went to another good home. So that I'm happy about.
Can I ask how your father died? I know it was an accident.
Yeah, my father died in a hunting accident. And, you know, he grew up on a farm and the segregated South in Louisiana, and he had hunted his whole life, and that's how they ate, you know. And growing up on a farm, that was really his connection to the land and to the past and to how humans had eaten for hundreds of years. So after he died, I thought a lot about, you know, this idea of the happy hunting ground, or, you know, Egyptian notions of the dead, as well as, you know, Southern traditions of funereal traditions. Song and food really became important to me after he died.
Was he shot by a friend he was hunting with?
Yes, it was an accident. So, yeah.
Did you know that friend, and did you talk to him?
I did know him. I really didn't talk to him after, but, you know, I forgave him for what was just an accident. For me, you know, I wasn't really worried about how he died, just that he died. And I think that was really what the book is about, too. It's really about that grappling with how anyone you know and love dies, but especially if they die suddenly, all the things that are said or not said, and sort of the dailiness of that. I really wanted to capture a kind of daybook of grief, I suppose.
How old was your father when he died?
He was 61, which, you know, is pretty young. You know, you don't know how much longer he would have been with us. So that's really hard sometimes. But, you know, it's coming on 10 years, and that seemed really important to me for the book. I mean, it'll be 10 years next month. And so for me, that was really symbolic for the book.
It being a sudden death, did you feel like there were things you so much wanted to say that you'll never get to say?
Well, I was fortunate. I had had a great talk with him, you know, just a few days before at Easter time. And so apart from its significance, and I think there's a poem called Easter in the book, it was also just, you know, refreshing to talk with him in such a kind of casual, friendly way. You know, so I felt felt lucky in a strange way that I'd had that chance to say just normal everyday things, and also to say I love you, which, you know, fathers and sons sometimes don't always say enough. And so that was really great, given the circumstances.
So your new book has a lot of poems about grief and mourning. One of the poems of mourning is for the miscarried baby, the miscarriage that your wife had. And it's a really good poem. I'd like to ask you to read it. Is that okay? Sure. Do you mind reading that?
Sure.
I just wanted to say, I know there's a lot of poems about grief and mourning, but they're good poems, and we've all been there. And if you haven't been there, I hate to put it this way, you will go. And it's nice to know there is good poems out there.
Well, thanks. I think miscarriage is something people don't always talk about. So, it really, for me, helped frame what happened after, which was the good news of a child. Miscarriage. 1 week after, we make love again for the first time, hopeful you're healed. And the wind still loud against new windows. The day dances around us into dark. What remains besides pain? How to mourn what's just a growing want? The baby books put away, the hand-me-downs will never hand. The heat shudders on, and against your chest, I nod off, hearing your lone heart whisper, uh-huh, 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 uh-huh.
How long after the miscarriage did you actually have a baby?
I don't exactly recall. Not soon enough, you know, but soon enough that we were, you know, felt really blessed and lucky.
How soon after the event that leaves you mourning do you actually sit down and write a poem? Do you actually feel capable of writing one, or even interested in writing one?
I mean, I think the hardest thing really is trying not to write. You know, there's a real desire to, as a poet, to kind of make a poem, and you're almost just writing for survival right after. You don't know anything else. It'd be like a swimmer. You would go for a long swim. It's what you know. At the same time, you know you're not going to achieve something, at least I felt that way. And it really wasn't till later, you know, I wrote some poems, as I said, that kind of broke the dam of that, and about food, and they were a way of looking to the side. But to write directly about it, it really took some time. I was trying to remember how long, a few years, but I had that kind of raw material from right after. And so they were really not poems, I hope, of memory so much as poems of the moment and those moments right after. And there was an immediacy I wanted, but I also wanted to capture a form, let's call it a music, that kind of fought against those feelings, those rawnesses. So there's a lot of rhyme and structure that I really want to apply, and that's what I hope makes it a poem and not, you know, just this raw experience, which can overwhelm one.
Kevin Young will be back in the second half of the show. His new collection of poems is called Book of Hours. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron Chair, including the True Black Color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From Road Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba this winter, at roadscholar.org. And from eSurance, with Coverage Counselor, a car insurance tool for helping customers select coverage limits, at eSurance.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, tech contributor Alexis Madrigal considers the self-driving car. He took a ride in one. Also, we listen back to an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Justin Kaplan, who was also an editor of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. He died Sunday. And we continue our interview with poet Kevin Young. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet Kevin Young, author of the new collection, Book of Hours. It's his eighth volume of poetry. He's edited seven collections, including The Art of Losing, Poems of Grief and Healing. His collection of essays, The Gray Album on the Blackness of Blackness, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Young is a professor of creative writing and English at Emory University. So we talked earlier about how, you know, your book is anchored with poems of grief for your father and poems of joy when your son is born. But there was a moment of fear when your son was born and had jaundice. And I just want you to read an excerpt of that poem. It's there's some really nice, you know, scary but nice descriptions in there. So would you mind reading an excerpt of that?
And not at all.
And why don't you introduce it for us?
You introduced it so well. It's simply called jaundice. It's hard being human. This morning, yellow overtook you, 1,000 yolks broken beneath your skin, splotches of red, and you not rousing, drowsy, listless, your head dips like a drunk's or a duck in a shooting gallery. Rung, we ring and bring you to a doctor whose worried brown face I try hiding from your mother. She weeps over your body, mottled, bare, losing weight. Your black, burnt-looking belly button, even your feet flushed. What color should you be? Hard to say, my black-eyed Susan, barely born.
You know, that line, what color should you be, is a line that you later repeat. What are the layers of meaning that line has for you?
Oh, I mean, I think it's about, you know, humanity, you know, like the beginning of the poem says. It's about race, I suppose, but it's also just about, you know, newness. You know, what should this being that you've birthed, or if you're my wife, you birthed, be? You know, you're trying to find everything out at once, and it can be so overwhelming. And all those layers, I think, were so important. And of course, you're just terrified. And I know, you know, other people experience those feelings too. And so I was just trying to capture that bewilderment, which isn't all bad, but also has that scary edge to it.
Your baby made a full recovery from the jaundice?
Perfectly fine. Playing football and catch just yesterday.
Good. You've written, it's hard to resist writing about fatherhood, but I actually don't as much now directly. That can get weird, like you're not having the experiences with your kid as much as poeticizing him or her. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, if you were playing catch and then ran back in and started writing catch poems, I don't know. There's something missing. For me, it was, you know, honestly, I almost decided as soon as he was sort of starting to talk, that's when I would stop the poems. I don't think I thought that so consciously. You know, they say wonderful things that you go and rush and write down. So it's not like, you know, that doesn't continue. But for this book, I really wanted it bound by that feeling. And, you know, that said, it was life way before it was a book. You know, when I wrote the jaundice poem, initially, I didn't know what would happen. And so it was only looking back that I was able to kind of turn it into a poem and make it something in this sequence that was about moving forward and moving on.
Your father was a doctor. Was your mother a doctor, too?
My mom's not a doctor of medicine, though she does have a PhD in chemistry and I think was the first black woman to get a PhD from University of Nebraska in chemistry, certainly. But growing up, they didn't talk about that. I mean, we just thought about home and Louisiana and that deep, deep country, which I love so much. And is, you know, that red clay, that's part of my growing up. And though I didn't, you know, ever live there, but they're growing up and my whole family lives there. And they both had come from, you know, similar backgrounds, and so I really applauded. Later, I came to understand all it took for them to carry all that with them as they moved around the country and did these different things and, you know, made my life and our lives possible.
How do they feel about you becoming a poet? Because you know how it is, like, so many people want their kids to, you know, have the security of a real job.
Which, yeah, I mean, I don't think my mom...
It's not the most lucrative thing. Like, you're lucky. You teach. You teach at Emory University, so you've got that job, but you wouldn't necessarily.
Yeah, no, I think my mom didn't breathe a sigh of relief till I finally got a job, though I had a book and, you know, had other things. I think that was a real relief.
You've written a lot about music, jazz, hip-hop, blues. Do you think music has influenced your poetry?
Absolutely. I think music is poetry in the sense that I think the condition of poetry I'm going for has some qualities of music that it aspires to. But I also think that what I love about poetry is the way that music is in the poem, is in the words themselves. It's not behind it. It's not in front of it. It is it. And music and the blues, say, have taught me a lot. And I think in this book, Book of Hours, there is this kind of blues sensibility. I mean, there's moments of humor, even in the sorrow. And I'm really interested in the way that you can, the blues have that tragic comic view of life, what Langston Hughes called laughing to keep from crying. So there was really that sustaining quality, that philosophy, if you will, that the blues provide.
Your book is called Book of Hours, and the final poem in your book is titled Book of Hours. So I want you to explain first what a Book of Hours is.
Well, I realize that it sounds like O-U-R-S, like our book, which I actually kind of love. But it also is, you know, a book of hours, H-O-U-R-S, which is, you know, a little devotional book people would have made. And people probably know them from their beautiful illuminated letters. And they were have this kind of intimate quality, though, of prayer and psalm. And I wanted to really capture that kind of intimacy, but also that almost more literal meaning of hours and days and moments in the process of grief and joy.
So I'm going to ask you to read from the final part of the title poem Book of Hours. But before we do, I want to say the first time I read this poem, I was worried you were dying.
Oh, no.
Yeah. That's probably not the reaction you wanted me to have, right?
No, I didn't. But, you know, I suppose it's about risk. It's about, I don't know, for me, it's more about resurrection. Maybe you have to go through that first phase in order to find that rebirth phase. But it has this quality. I mean, in the beginning of the poem, I say, what good are wishes if they aren't used up? And for me, that was really... some kind of motto toward the end of the book and the end of that process, I suppose.
So would you read the end of this for us?
Yes. Yeah, this is toward the end of the poem. And the beginning part is imagining what's a beloved, the you in the poem, who's both real and imagined, will think or feel upon learning that the speaker has died.
Yes, you can see why I thought you were dead. Not dead, but dying. You can see why I was worried
about
you.
Well, we're all, I suppose, you know.
Yes.
But no, only in that way.
Okay.
Other arms will lift you up, I know. Carry you crying to my grave. The weeds and weather will sing my name. Look away. Let them let me down without you watching. Sunflowers, their heads seek the sun, or bend without one, even after cut, angling in the water toward what brightness we borrow. It's death there is no cure for, life the long disease, if we're lucky. Otherwise, short trip beyond and below, noon, growing shadow. I chase the quiet round the house. Soon the sound, wind wills its way against the panes. Welcome the rain. Welcome the moon's squinting into space. The trees bow like priests. The storm lifts up the leaves. Why not sing?
You know, most of our conversation has been about grief, with poems about grief. So, like, why not sing doesn't seem to be a bad note to end on, and an interesting note for your book to end on.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, if anything, it's a bit like the end of Whitman in the sense of the same wish. You know, he's imagining one day I'll be part of the grass and look for me under your boot soles, that will be somehow redemptive. And so... I don't know, singing is the closest I can come to that feeling. of not a song just of the self, but of, you know, why not sing now? Why not raise our voices in praise or however we think of it? And for me, that was really the end of the book always. I was glad it made it there.
Well, Kevin Young, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Kevin Young is the author of the new collection of poems, Book of Hours. Coming up, we remember biographer Justin Kaplan, who also edited two volumes of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. He died Sunday. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember Justin Kaplan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer who also edited the 16th edition of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, published in 1992, and the 17th edition, published in 2002. Justin Kaplan died Sunday at the age of 88. His first book, a 1966 biography of Mark Twain, won a National Book Award as well as a Pulitzer. He also wrote biographies of Walt Whitman and Lincoln Steffens. I spoke with Kaplan about editing Bartlett's Familiar Quotations in 1992. The first volume was published in 1855 by John Bartlett. In the 16th edition, Kaplan included contemporary quotes, including movie quotes, like this famous line spoken by Robert Duvall in the film Apocalypse Now.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory. Apocalypse Now certainly is a classic movie about the Vietnam era, but to go beyond that, I gave a fair amount of thought to where people get their quotations from these days. They don't, this is an obvious statement, they don't quote from Shakespeare and the Bible or Virgil as much as they used to. In fact, they don't quote from them at all. If you listen to the conversation of rather well-educated people, for example, meeting at a party, you'll find that the common ground that they immediately find is the movies. And the movies supply the so-called lingua franca of our era, and the movies are where most quotations these days come from.
Well, public radio listeners will be pleased to know that you quote Garrison Keillor.
Well, I thought he belonged here. I thought he was absolutely essential.
You want to read the quote?
Well, I put in two quotations from Garrison Keillor. I think both of them are firmly rooted in the American memory by now. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. And, of course, the second is a description of the town. It's the little town that time forgot, that the decades cannot improve.
I wonder if Garrison knows he's in here. Do you let people know that they're going to be in Bartlett's?
No, I let them find out the hard way simply by looking at the book. They do not get a letter of notification, no.
James Brown has made it into Bartlett's. Say
yes.
It loud, I'm black and I'm proud.
Right.
Your choice?
I believe so, yes.
Now, there's a quote that our listeners will probably remember. Love means not ever having to say you're sorry. That's Eric Siegel from the movie Love Story. How did you feel about having that in Bartlett's quotation? It's really, I think, one of the kind of cornier quotes, or certainly become that.
Well, it's certainly one of the stupidest single lines of dialogue ever written. But it is so stupid and so meaningless that, again, it became burned in the American memory. And I believe that there's a later movie in which Ryan O'Neill, who played in the original Love Story, another movie in which Ryan O'Neill quotes the line and says something like, I think that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Well, regardless of its stupidity, that's the one thing from Love Story that you can count on people remembering.
But you didn't feel the need to put in parentheses, I, the editor of this edition, do not really believe this is a profound thought.
I do not indicate when I put a clothespin over my nose.
I sometimes think of Bartlett's quotations as being a book for cheaters, for people who have a luncheon address or a speech they have to give, and they want to say something profound, so they'll quickly find a quote in Bartlett's, and then they'll say it as if these words have guided them all their life, you know, and that the person who they're quoting has been a lifelong influence upon them. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, that's one use for it. People do use quotations to dress up their own thoughts, to impress people. And Bartlett's, as a reference book, is an invaluable tool in doing that. But I think it goes way beyond that. I like to think of it not simply as a reference book, but as a reading book. It's a rather unique anthology. It is, after all, not arranged like a dictionary alphabetically, which is the way most quotation books are arranged. It's arranged chronologically, which seems at first glance rather odd and maybe a little unwieldy as far as using the book is concerned. But what that gives the book is a very special character of a reading book. You can start at the beginning with ancient Egypt, if you choose, and you work your way up to the present time. And you may have the feeling that you're hearing people of a certain era. You're getting the flavor of a certain era as time moves along.
You're a biographer in addition
to
editing Bartlett's. And two of the people who you've written biographies of are two of the most quoted Americans, Mark Twain and Walt Whitman. Did you often see them quoted out of context or, you know, quoted, you know, with the wrong interpretation?
Well, Mark Twain is always being either overquoted or misquoted. And I did a certain amount of correction in the Mark Twain section here. I redid all of the Mark Twain quotations because I thought the Mark Twain that we value these days is much more Mark Twain the satirist and Mark Twain the vernacular artist. And so I tended to reduce the amount of, you know, pure sentiment which some people associate with Mark Twain. In the way of restoring balance, I've restored to Mark Twain the famous quip, everyone grumbles about the weather, but no one does anything about it. My predecessors had attributed that to a friend of Mark Twain's named Charles Dudley Warner. I'm pretty sure that it belongs to Mark Twain. On the other hand, there's another quip that people have associated with Mark Twain, and that is, Wagner's music is better than it sounds. But if you look at Mark Twain's autobiography, he directly attributes that to a fellow humorist named Bill Nye, and that's where the credit goes this time.
So it's time for us to wrap up. Should I ask you something silly, like can you leave us with an inspiring quote? You must get asked this all the time. It must be really frustrating.
I suppose if I had to come up with an inspiring quote, it would be of a distinctly vernacular sort. It's a quotation attributed to Yogi Berra, and I have to underline the word attributed. I like it very much. It runs, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. make of that what you want.
That's great.
Justin Kaplan recorded in 1992. He died Sunday at the age of 88. Coming up, our tech contributor, Alexis Madrigal, takes a ride in a self-driving car. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Driverless cars, once a futuristic sci-fi concept like smartphones and tablet computers, are closer than ever to becoming a reality. Tech companies and traditional car companies are developing automobiles that someday might give the blind and disabled greater mobility and be able to drive the kids to soccer practice. Fresh Air tech contributor Alexis Madrigal looks at the current state of car automation as well as what's just down the road.
If you've heard about autonomous vehicles, cars that drive themselves, you probably associate them with Google, which is working on fully autonomous vehicles that will drive us to and fro while we're safely texting on our Android phones from the passenger seat. Not to be outdone by a tech company, the traditional car makers have major development programs too. The Mercedes S500 intelligent drive concept vehicle recently drove 100 kilometers between German cities. Nissan has promised some kind of autonomous vehicle by 2020, and GM's ENV concept car is a funny little electric pod that would detect pedestrians in a crosswalk and automatically slow the vehicle. Could also communicate with smart infrastructure and traffic optimization apps to, say, detect that a drawbridge is up and plot a route around it. Ford imagines packs of vehicles sensing their surroundings with stubby horn-like antennae and communicating about traffic conditions amongst themselves. There are a lot of steps, however, between Henry Ford's Model T and Google's autonomous Model X. Car makers need to figure out how to make vehicle-to-vehicle communication work, prove the safety and reliability of new technologies, and make them cheaper. Google's cars use tens of thousands of dollars worth of sensors. They also require a level of trust in the onboard computer that I at least find it difficult to muster. And let's not forget the problems of insuring a vehicle without a driver. Most of us, then, are going to encounter autonomous driving in little autopilot moments when we cede temporary control to a computer. In the near future, cars will take over for us in those special driving situations that teenagers practice for their driver's tests. Parallel parking? Let the car find the perfect angle of approach. Squeezing into a tight space? Hop out and press a button on your smartphone. Already, in Nissan's new vehicles, the car detects when you've missteered into a turn and silently guides the wheels along a better trajectory. In the Volkswagen Passat, a technology detects the lane markings on the road with a front-mounted camera and gently countersteers if you begin to wander from your lane. Where Volkswagen is pushing the furthest, though, is in its Audi luxury car line. Some models already have an advanced cruise control that uses a long-range radar system to detect other cars and automatically adjust one's speed to maintain a safe following distance. And they're going further. I was recently invited to a demonstration of their newest generation of research projects. In the parking lot at Candlestick Park, south of San Francisco, I was riding in the back of a fancy Audi, following another Audi through two lines of orange cones. As the car in front of us stopped, the lanky German driving our car indicated that he was going to look away from the road and slam on the accelerator. And he did, and we did not crash. That's because two cameras mounted near the rear and side view mirrors had detected the movement of the driver's head, meaning his eyes, away from the front of the car, and using software developed at the University of California, San Diego, had told the car's onboard computer to switch into autopilot. As our driver pumped his knee up and down, wildly pressing on the accelerator, the car came to a perfectly smooth stop and waited for our man to take back control of the car. The larger point is that futuristic visions distract us from the ways in which cars are already making decisions for us. With each new generation of vehicles, they're taking on more and more tasks, proving themselves in particular situations. By the time Google's cars arrive in your driveway, you'll be acclimated to the idea of an artificial intelligence grabbing the wheel because you'll have handed over control tens of thousands of times. That's not to say that the transition will be smooth or without consequence, but that the many technical, legal, and personal hurdles that autonomous cars face will be worked out in much more limited settings, like the blacktop of the Candlestick parking lot or in the moment when you drift from a lane. This is how the future creeps into the present. While it might seem like your main computing device transformed from a Dell desktop into a smartphone overnight, there were thousands of little steps along the way that led to the moment when you realized the world has changed beyond recognition.
Alexis Madrigal is a visiting scholar at Berkeley's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he edits the tech section of their website. You can watch a video of one of the cars he mentioned on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain at Lumosity.com. From Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, boats, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. And from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
The caricatures of Tammany Hall's Boss Tweed in 19th century political cartoons became a symbol of corrupt machine politics. On the next Fresh Air, historian Terry Galway offers a different take. He says Tammany Hall provided struggling immigrants with needed social services and got legislation enacted that foreshadowed the New Deal. Galway's new book is called Machine Made. Join us.